Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another show of Beyond the Cover, hosted, of course, by John Robb and Jeff Ayers. Jeff, how you doing tonight?
Doing well. I was wondering what show's on for a sec there.
Yeah, I didn't know what a shock was, but I'm just tongue-tied already. It's only freaking 7:30. The show just started. I already can't freaking talk. But
good night, everybody.
We have a great guest.
Yeah.
There we go. We're off. But tonight's guest is actually going to be coming on in the middle of the show, so it's going to be a little bit different in the second half, but it's none other than number one New York Times bestselling author Nelson DeMille, and he's going to be talking about his newest book, Radiant Angel, along with some other things, so that's going to be exciting. So we're just going to flip-flop the show this week, aren't we, Jeff?
Yeah, we are. Sounds like fun.
Yeah, how we normally start the second half of the show is let's talk about, you know, what we're reading. So let's hit it with you, and let's get right on, and let's talk about, you know, what's on your bookshelf, what are you reading, what kind of things do you see coming down the pike?
Well, I have one I want to talk about called The Wrong Man by Kate White. And Kate White she was the former editor-in-chief of Cosmopolitan, and she's a New York Times bestselling author of several really good books. And this one is a standalone, and the basic idea is that this young woman decides to flirt with a guy at a hotel when she's on vacation, and one thing leads to another, if you know what I mean. And
one thing leads to another.
Oh, yeah, exactly. So after they have their fling, they decided initially that, you know, just be one night thing, that's it. But then when she's leaving to go back home, he says, hey, let's get back together when I'm back in New York. I want to see you again. So she goes to see him when he's back and knocks on his apartment door, and a guy answers, and she says, hi, I'm looking for, his name's Matt. And he says, oh, I'm Matt. And you realize right then and there that the person she'd been with was not who he said he was. And then it gets all stalkery.
Gotcha. Interesting.
Yeah, and
Kate is a very, very interesting lady. We've had her in the magazine and had her on the show before, and she's very interesting, and she's so funny, and she's so nice and very appreciative of everything. You would never think that the ex-editor-in-chief from Cosmopolitan is writing thriller books. Think romance right off the bat, of course.
Right. But no, she writes really good thrillers, and she was on a panel I was moderating at Book Expo America, which we'll talk about here shortly. But, I had one other book I'm just starting. Someone near and dear to our hearts, John Sanford, is writing a science fiction novel.
Whoa!
Sci-fi.
This is different than Lucas Davenport, and what is the other one? Virgil Flower? So this is not even a series. It's just something totally out of the blue, huh? Something different.
Yes, and he's writing it with a guy, and I'm not going to get the name right, so I'm just going to spell it. It's C-T-E-I-N.
C-T-E-I-N.
Yeah, and I guess he's a bit... C-T-E-I-N.
How about Satan? Satine?
Something like that, yeah. The guy is supposed to be really big in the sci-fi community.
You know what? We'll see what they did in The Bronze Tale, and we'll just call him C. Because Carl Alderaan was too long of a name. This guy's C, too.
All right. Well, so John Sanford's writing it with this guy, and the book is called Saturn Run. So maybe this is the start of something new and interesting. Yeah. It is coming out in October, and they were just passing these things out at BEA. So I've just started digging in, and it's got the suspense you'd expect from a John Sanford, but it's clearly not what you're used to either.
Well, now what's it about? Like what exactly are they getting into? Because this is something totally out of his realm.
Yeah, I'm not even totally enough into it to tell you that, because I'm still like, wait, what's going on? But I will say it takes place in 2066.
Okay, so it's a future science. Okay, so it's a future book.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, is it a future book set in a totally different, is it like a parallel world to the U.S., you know, to Earth? Actually, what he thinks the Earth will be in 2066 kind of thing. You know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I don't see it as a alternate history future type thing. I see it as something they envision our world will be like come 51 years from now.
Okay, yeah. So it's not like a parallel, like, universe, you know what I mean, kind of thing.
No, nothing like that at all.
Oh, God.
Yeah, so,
now,
you got to make sure you can get a copy yourself.
I do. I got to make sure I get a copy of that. I'll have to email the publicist and say, hey, send it over. You know, I like science fiction.
Especially if it's good thriller.
I don't know if a lot of people know this because it's not something that I really say, but my number one favorite genre actually is fantasy. That's like the one that I like to gravitate to the most, because a lot of the times, the only difficult part about fantasy, like in a Game of Thrones series or Lord of the Rings, stuff like that, it can be the different language that's made up, and sometimes the names are so much different, I kind of have to give them regular names like Jack and John and Charlie and Bill, just because sometimes they're outlandish, so just so I can remember them. But the storylines are the things that always get me. So my picks of the week, if you want to call it that, is going back old school a little bit. Not that old, but kind of old school. And I picked up a series that you might find interesting. I've never finished. I've started, I've read some through, I've gotten to certain points, but I've never finished the whole thing. And this time I'm bound to determine that I'm going to finish it. And that is the Dark Tower series by Stephen King.
Ah, Stephen King, yes.
Yeah, you know, well, I'm not gonna lie, he's my number one favorite author of all time, and so I decided, you know what, I listened to the second and the fourth book on tape, so I never really read them. So I don't know, the books on tape count? I think it counts because it's the same thing. And
yeah,
I read The Wolves of Kala, but then I stopped and I couldn't go any further. I forget why. I mean, there was a lot of stuff going on or whatever. But a lot of the stuff I forgot about. I mean, I revisited The Gunslinger and I went back. So I don't know if a lot of people have read the whole series through. There was a lot of controversy on the last book. Did you read the whole series?
I had to quit about 3 in.
Now, why?
Sorry.
Why did you quit after The Wastelands?
I just got kind of bored with the whole thing, and I didn't really care about him. And I kind of didn't see where it was going. So I just, like, yeah, I love Stephen King too, but I just, and then also I had the feeling he was never going to finish it.
Well, you know that they're all done, would you go back?
No, and the reason I say that's because the stuff I heard about the last book especially.
Yes,
so yeah, you have to tell me.
Well, I do know how it ends because my wife read it and she kind of told me, because I didn't think I was ever going to finish them. So I do know kind of how it ends, but that doesn't really concern me that much, just because of how it ended, and I won't give it away. But it's controversial, like The Sopranos. But I think when you take a step back maybe and you read the whole thing, and then if you know how it ends, then you kind of see. A lot of people now think that the way The Sopranos ended was classic.
I think
people were mad at the beginning.
Yeah.
But I think when they look back at it, I think they're like, you know what? That was actually the right way to do it. So I don't know how many people want to go back, you know, and read that kind of stuff. But the Dark Tower series, the writing alone, just how he can captivate a scene and characters is really like no other I've ever seen. I mean, it really isn't.
He can do it with one sentence. The man's a genius.
He can. And
yeah.
For all the great thriller writers that we know at ITW and all the great writers that we've had on and this and that, I honestly can't say that if you give me a book and you say, read this, and I don't know who it is, and I don't know the character names, or you change the names, and it's just the scene, I don't think you would be able to pick out who wrote that unless it was him. I think he's that unique.
When Thinner came out by Richard Bachman years ago, I was reading that book, and I said, this is Stephen King. It was so obviously a Stephen King book, I thought, my God. And then it came out shortly after that. Oh, yeah, in fact, that was Stephen King who wrote it. And I read other Richard Bachmans, but didn't realize it was Stephen King. But that one was obviously Stephen King.
Yeah, I think Dean Koontz, I think Brad Thor, trying to think else
Dean
maybe off
Koontz
the top of my head.
Dean Koontz, to me, I love his older stuff.
That's all I was going
like
to say.
His new stuff
the
now.
Older stuff. His newer stuff,
he seems to have become obsessed with weather, and I don't understand that. every single book has page after page about just describing the weather, and it gets really annoying. And
I think some do. I just think it's almost like what was the show? I think was it South Park? I think it was a South Park show that said The Simpsons did it. And every storyline they tried to come up with within the show, they were like, yeah, The Simpsons already did it. The Simpsons already did it. Really, unless you're writing military thriller, you set up a storyline and you're like, oh, okay, I got it. So the car is evil. And it's like, oh, well, Stephen King already did that. Okay, better yet. Okay, so you have these aliens that have kind of left something in the yard and they find it. And now it starts, oh, Stephen King, that Tommyknockers. It's like almost thing you ever try to think of. It's like, oh, yeah, he did that. And he even runs freaking fantasy in Eyes of the Dragon. And even the Sandman.
Which I enjoyed that one.
Fantasy. Right. So it's like, I mean, the guy writes Stand By Me, Shawshank, and whatever. But I just think, you know, so The Dark Tower is for me a rediscovering, just taking a break from all the new books. And letting our reviewers read them more than me read them. So I'm trying to actually read for a little fun, but it's also good because now that I'm writing and we're developing this new series called Green Lake, that it helps me to read more authors that are kind of take away from outside the boundaries and aren't straight kind of cookie cutter, you know, thrillers and suspense. It's kind of the same kind of formula. So I'm just kind of taking a little bit of a break from that.
I got you.
Are you breathing heavy? Because you're like, are you windy? Or what did you do? Did you open the window in Seattle? Come on, what are you doing?
I did. So, gosh, all right. Hang in.
That's all right. We all need
a
little wind
funny.
Now.
Okay.
But yes, now, let's get into the topic of BEA. This is one thing that I've never been to. I don't really know a lot about it. You just attended it. It was in New York, about a month or so before. So tell us, for someone who, and for people who hear the word BEA, but they don't know what it is and what the purpose of it is, what is it?
BEA is short for Book Expo America, and essentially it's the publisher's trade show. And just imagine Javits Center, which is a giant hall, and aisle after aisle and booth after booth of all of the various publishers promoting their upcoming books. Get even more interesting, a lot of the authors are there as well. So this year, the John Grisham was signing, David Baldacci was signing, Mary Higgins Clark was signing. I met Mindy Kaling real briefly, the actress from The Office and The Mindy Project. I met John Leguizamo, the actor who's been in lots of stuff, including Chef, and he does a voice.
What was
he
writing?
He did a graphic novel.
So because this is all genres, right? This is everything from cookbooks down to serial killers and horror, right? Everything in between.
That's correct. Yeah, in fact, the Horror Writers Association, the Romance Writers Association, and the Mystery Writers Association all had booths, and they had members of their groups signing books. And that was really neat.
Go ahead. Is this a fan event? I mean, do fans go there to get books signed? Okay, so the authors are autographing for, like, yourself, like reviewers, or me, like the magazine?
They are primarily there for booksellers, librarians, and press. And you would
call who are they autographing for?
Mostly booksellers and librarians who are there.
Oh, okay.
And they're wandering around. And let's just give you a graphic here. When they first open the doors to the hall, there's this mad rush, kind of like what I imagine the Best Buy would be on Black Friday at 6 a.m.
Okay.
And everything that is not nailed down is grabbed like you wouldn't believe. And it's basically, you know, advanced copies of books or swag.
Okay.
They give away a lot of bags and things like that. And it's the publisher's opportunity to promote books that they think people should be alerted to that are coming out in the next few months. And it's a perfect opportunity for them to talk to booksellers and say, hey, you should be promoting this book, or librarians. Or, you know, in my case, since I review for several places, they were talking to me about, oh, you should review this book, and here's why. Or in one case, we're talking about getting that particular author on our show for a future episode. So, yeah.
Right.
It's nice in the sense that when you're emailing people, you know, you have nice conversations by email, but seeing a face-to-face really makes a difference. And being in New York is awesome.
Well, yeah, and so now, basically, I mean, you got two major booksellers in the country, right? You got Barnes & Noble, and you got Books A Million. Barnes & Noble, of course, is by far larger than Books A Million. But they're still about the only kind of chain that is anything. So do you have a lot of independent booksellers there? Because the reason I ask is because you said
That's the majority of them.
which was kind of interesting, is that there was a lot of empty space more than normal. And my question is that because when you really only have two players in town, and both of them you have to pay to play, which what I mean is you have to pay to get those books into the front section. Otherwise, they're just going to go on the back cover, they're just going to go on the back walls, into the shelves, and people have to go find them. Is it really beneficial to publishers to do it, since there's really no fans there to draw a lot of interest? Because I think the Amazon hot new release section is maybe a place where people go, or they go on Goodreads or Facebook and they hear about new things. What do you think about that?
Well, let me back up a minute. The majority of the people on the show floor at any given time are the independent booksellers. People like Barnes & Noble, they're probably walking around there, but I didn't see any of them. All the people I saw were either librarians or independent booksellers. The people that have displays set up include a lot of the wholesalers where you order your books from, and they have new programs, and they're offering discounts if you ordered from the show floor. So instead of, say, a 35% discount for your items, they'll give you a 45% discount or something like that.
So like Ingram would be like an Ingram.
Ingram was there. Baker & Taylor was there, yes.
Okay.
And they had a lot of the places like NetGalley had a booth set up and talking about their product. And NetGalley essentially is for people like us. When we review books, you can get it digitally ahead of a print copy. And sometimes it's really nice, especially if you're in a hurry and you live across the country. It's nice that way. So, yeah, so they had a display set up. And a lot of the really tiny presses had booths set up and promoting their authors and their books as well. And, yeah, you know,
it seems like a lot of time and a lot of money to sell to an independent book guy who might own two bookstores and might take a total of 20 copies. It just seems like a lot of work. But you know what?
Right.
Maybe it worked. I don't know. Do you see self-published authors walking around to these places and trying to get them to buy their books? I mean, that's what I would think is like maybe a self-published author is running around and doing that stuff too.
they had their own special section this year, and they were very aggressive. You know, hey, read my book. And
well, yeah, like they gotta be because they gotta get themselves seen.
Exactly, and they were doing their best to be seen. And some cases, people were dressed up in mascot costumes. You know, and of course, you immediately go, "Why is this person dressed like Peter Pan?" You got to ask these questions. And like,
yeah,
oh, hey, I
do.
Wrote a book. It has nothing whatsoever to do with Peter Pan, but I'm Peter Pan. Like, okay, whatever. it's essentially a big party, and the publishers kind of rewarding their staff and also their authors who come there as a thank you as well.
I gotcha. Okay. Yeah, because we've been asked several times. Every year they ask us to go, and every year we're like, okay, this is going to cost us about $2,000 to go out there. What benefit are we going to get from this? And since we've never really had a correct answer of what we're going to get from it, we've always decided we're not going to go. Even though we are a publisher, we're more of an electronic publisher than we are a print publisher for just, you know, for various reasons, don't need to get into. But we were just like, yeah, I just don't think that it's worth it for us. And you went, and so you think that this is the lowest population total that have been there?
I would say that. I haven't seen the exact numbers, but when other people are telling you, yeah, it isn't as busy as I thought it was going to be,
yeah,
it makes me wonder. And next year it's going to be in Chicago. And
that's killer. It's
that
done.
Really makes me wonder.
I wonder
how it's going to do.
Because you're not going to, as a publisher, now you really have to decide, now this is going to cost us $10,000, $12,000, $15,000 to fly our staff out there, to get hotel rooms, to do all this stuff. Is it going to be worth it? You know, I don't know. I think that's idiotic to move it to Chicago when all the publishers are in New York. Let's face it.
Yeah, I understand that Chicago will bring a different audience. But at the same time, if I'm one of the bigger publishers and I have one of those fancy booths that have, you know, the TV monitors that alternate book covers,
right,
and it looks like a really nice office with the tables and all that stuff, you got to say, hey, how much is this going to cost to ship from New York to Chicago and back?
And how many books do we
bring?
Yeah, and you said that there's going to get a different kind of people. But what different kind of people is it going to get? It's not like you're going to get fans. Again, I'm just always wondering, if the money's in New York, and that's where the publishers and the agents and the publicists typically are in this business, percent of them, I would think, or have to be there. I mean, I don't know about the exact number, but that's my guess. Then why would you ever want to take it away from where the people who run this thing are at and move it to another city? Because since it's not a fan event. Fans event like VoucherCon and things like that, I absolutely agree they should change cities.
Well, let me clarify something. So there's Book Expo America, which is it was from Wednesday to Friday. What they've started doing is a fan event on Saturday and Sunday called BookCon. This year they had John Green, and my daughter was like, you didn't meet John Green. But anyway, so that's sort of the fan event portion of it.
You should have said, honey, that's a fault in my star.
Yeah, we would have to live in a paper town, I tell you. But anyway, that's more geared toward the fans. But the publishers do lots of different things with that as well.
Well, hopefully,
and
fans can see new releases coming out. But of course, they're not going to see. They're not going to be able to buy the books. Maybe they'll give some of them away. But they won't be able to buy the books, and they'll have probably just the latest book there that they can see. So, I don't know. I mean, I love Thriller Fest, and I love some of the events. Do we get a lot of kick out of it? No, we don't get a lot of kick out of Thriller Fest. I mean, it's more networking and smoozing for us to go around than it is to try to find new readers and places like that. It's a place where we let people know who we are and more along the lines of that, and we get to have, you know, time with you and time with other people that we really don't see, so it's a way for us to get together. But other than that, that's about how we view it. And we've been you know, doing this for 7-8 years. And it's just like, you know, this is just kind of how we view it. It's, we don't get a big kick out of monetarily wise. We get a big kick out of it social wise. And that's why we like to go.
Right. I did a lot of networking myself. And I was back there actually to moderate a panel, which went really well. But, yeah, I saw, like, John Land and several other authors and publicists. And so, yeah, it was a networking experience for me as well.
Awesome.
And also I did a lot of stuff for my day job as well. So it was a worthwhile trip for me, but it's because I was wearing so many different hats. For someone like you, just being a publisher, I don't think it would be worth your while, because a lot of the stuff you would do there, you could just do as easily at Thriller Fest.
Well, I'll tell you what, Jeff, why don't we take a break here? We're going to wait for Nelson. He hopefully will be on shortly. And so you want to do that? Let's take a quick break, and then we can come back after
Sounds
the break,
good.
And hopefully Nelson will be called in. Otherwise, you're just going to hear us gaff for another half hour, which is not a bad thing, because we have other topics we can get into. So, all right, let's just take a quick break, and we will be right back after this. But, however, I have to let you know that we have a sponsor for this show. Did you know that?
We do.
We got a
I didn't know that.
So Suspense Radio and this show, Beyond the Cover, is brought to you by the New American Library, which is the publisher of the most provocative thriller of the year called Eenie Meenie by M.J. Arledge, or I'm going to say that, Arledge. Lisa Gardner calls it an international bestseller, mesmerizing. Tammy Hoag also says it's white knuckles guarantee, and this book is on sale wherever books are sold. Have you read Eenie Meenie yet?
I have not, but that's one that Kimberly Howe was talking about how much she liked when she was on the show.
Yeah, and so I have not been able to read it yet, but you know, Lisa Gardner, Tammy Hoag are two of the top. So I mean, if they're going to say that this is pretty much a mesmerizing and white knuckle guaranteed, I would say that you should probably go check out Eenie Meenie. Again, that is by author M.J. Arledge, Arledge, and it's called Eenie Meenie. So go check it out today. And now we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back after this. Whoa! And so we got a little bit. Sorry about that. The song got over with. I just noticed the time. I do apologize. We are back. So, Jeff, how you doing again?
Doing good.
We did know that Nelson had an event, and we moved his time back to the late time for the simple fact because he did have an event. So he might not make it on. If he doesn't, that's okay. I'm sure we could probably try to get him on again. But that doesn't mean that we don't have to talk about his stuff. Like I said, off the air, when did you first discover Nelson DeMille and his book? What was your first book on him?
My first book was Cathedral, which came out in the 80s. And it was just this amazing suspenseful thriller set in St. Patrick's Cathedral. And that was always a place that fascinated me as a kid. And reading a thriller set there was pretty awesome. And even had a nice little map of the church. And it was like, wow,
cool.
This is pretty awesome. Yeah.
Now, did you read it
and
when
then
it
I
first
just
came
been
out?
Devouring... No.
It looked like it came out in 81. So then I guess the thing that could already come out, how did you get turned on to want to read him? What was the draw?
The book was so good, I thought, I like this book. I like the writing. What else has this guy done?
No, I know, but how did you? Why did you pick up Cathedral? Why did you pick up Nelson DeMille even in the first place?
It was just the basic story idea about a thriller set in St. Patrick's Cathedral, and that
I got
the idea of that just fascinated me. Yeah,
yeah, I'm not gonna lie. I picked up my first Nelson DeMille book, which was Plum Island, and I actually listened to the audio version of that first. Like I was saying off the air, I used to work for Ohio State, and the job that I had, basically in front of a computer, and I was just inputting information in about students all day long so I could wear headphones, and I would listen to audiobooks. I was doing it because what I was doing was just a monkey could do it, which is why I didn't get paid a lot, but I got free schooling. And so I'm not going to lie, I picked it up nearly, only reason I picked that book up was to read it, and I got it out of the library because it had just come out. The library had an audiobook. I saw it, I picked up, and it was merely off the cover. I know, I'm superficial, but it was the cover.
It's a terrific book.
It was great. So then what else did you jump into him with then? Because he just has this new one out called Radiant Angel, which is the next, I guess it's seventh book in his John Corey series, which started with Plum Island in 1997.
That's right. People can see my review out there. I reviewed the Radiant Angel for AP, but you mentioned the next book I discovered, he actually co-wrote with someone else, and I didn't realize it at the time, was Mayday. That book came out under the name Thomas Block. And then actually, come to find out, Nelson wrote it with Thomas Block, and now it's actually part of his bio. Came out, it was not. And I like that book a lot, and then finding out later, so that's kind of cool.
Now, I think, and I could be wrong, but I think the only one of his books to turn into a movie was The General's Daughter. Now, again, I could be wrong about this. I don't know for sure, but I think, is that the only one that turned into a movie?
Say no. I think something else did.
Oh,
I think Mayday
was
made into
more.
A TV movie.
There was one. You're right. In 2003, there was one for TNT called Word of Honor. So Word of Honor was put out there.
And there's that too, yes.
The General's Daughter was the only major box office release. And did you know it's a top five Paramount picture of all time at $250 million?
Really? Really?
It says it on his website.
Okay.
It says on his website. And, you know, Mayday was actually a CBS TV Sunday night movie in October 2nd, 2005.
That's what I thought, yes.
How interesting.
Yeah. So who was in General's Daughter?
You didn't see? Oh, man.
I've seen it. Yep.
Oh, that was John
Travolta,
Madeline
knew.
Stowe, James Woods. And, oh, God, who was the Timothy, let me hold on, Timothy, I'm just gonna go on IMDb and just run it out. But I mean, it had a great cast. I mean, you know,
yes.
John Travolta. This was during John Travolta's kind of resurgence of himself, because he was kind of having to resurge himself after he made so many crappy movies, and he rose kind of out of it a little bit. But then Pulp Fiction kind of took him back up. And so that was kind of in this era. And so I thought he did an outstanding job in the movie.
Timothy Hutton.
The movie was great. Timothy Hutton. But then the general was also a bigger name. Okay, here I got it now. Let's see. Who was the general? James Cromwell. I mean, James Cromwell was fabulous.
Yes.
And then... Yes. Trying to think who else was maybe a bigger name. Clarence Williams was the Colonel Fowler. So I thought it was a great cast. I thought it was a great movie. And, you know, that's one of the things where people say, oh, well, the book is better than the movie. Well, that might be so, but I still think that this movie was very, very entertaining. And that was the second book that I read or listened to him. And then I went in and I happened to finally get he finally did a little bit more on the John Corey, and I saw and I read Lion's Game, and then I went back to some of the standalone stuff. I like Charm School, and I actually did listen to Word of Honor, so I went back to some of that. But I like his books because he's another writer that, while he is still a suspense kind of thriller, there's a lot of uniqueness to his writing. There's a lot of uniqueness to his stories. It doesn't remind me of cookie cutter stories like we kind of talked about. You get the same feeling?
I do. He can write about anything, and he has such a nice style and voice that it's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And he could talk about anything from the Vietnam War to terrorism, and it just works.
Well, what did your review say?
Could
you give a little bit of your review, or were the AP shut us down?
I basically said that it was a terrific entry in the series, that John Corey is one of those heroes that you love but you don't like because he's so politically incorrect.
Yeah.
And that's actually a question I want to ask him about. And there is a tendency in this one to be a little bit over the top in terms of the violence, and I don't know why he chose that way this time. And it was kind of a little off-putting at times, but it still is a terrific book.
Hmm. Well,
so that's what I said.
Maybe he was, and I think a lot of authors do this sometimes. It could have been an experimental thing. Maybe it was something he was experimenting with. Maybe it was something that he decided, hey, I want to kind of, you know, see how this goes. Or, you know, I don't know if he's an organic writer, if he's an outline writer. Maybe the story took him there. So sometimes you just never know. And I think that's what makes it fascinating by listening to, you know, these authors. Especially, I guess, I always talk to people about this. When they listen, if they listen back to the Jeffrey Deaver show, and he literally is explaining to you how he writes a book, I think that I find that fascinating. To me, that's more fascinating than sometimes than the book itself, you know, how the creation
right.
comes. I love watching the behind-the-scenes stuff. One of my favorite is that is Halloween and the 25th anniversary DVD where they talk about the behind-the-scenes and how the movie was made and the little idiosyncrasies that you didn't catch on to, and then they talk about, like, have you ever seen the movie Halloween?
I have to say that is some of the best music I've ever heard in that movie. I love that music, and the director made it. I'm like, holy cow,
he
the director
made it.
Composed
he
the
made
music.
It
How cool is that?
Over the weekend. He did it in 2 days
yeah.
over the weekend, John Carpenter. But you do know where Halloween
Amazing.
Was filmed. It was supposed to be in Illinois. And
okay.
if you really watch the movie, though, okay, it was actually filmed on a street in Pasadena, California. There's three shots when they're walking down the street with Jamie Lee Curtis and the whole thing. You do see palm trees. In the distance, you can literally see the mountains if you're looking when they shoot a shot down the street. No mountains in Illinois, people, No freaking palm trees. The other thing that John Carpenter thought was funny was when they did the screening, he was very, very nervous that people were going to catch on that this was supposed to be fall. But, of course, in California, our leaves don't really fall off the trees that early in Halloween. They take it with into December. So a lot of the shots are trees, their leaves still on them. So they had these three or four giant trash bags full of these leaves that they had to blow across the scene. So he was like, so hopefully people don't look at the trees and they just see the leaves. And then they had to say cut, and then they go freaking pick up the leaves and put them in the bag. Because he filmed that freaking movie. He made that whole movie on $210,000. And the only reason he went over by $10,000 is because he had to pay Donald Pleasance a bonus for coming on the movie.
Wow. You remind me of a Jackie Chan movie called Rumble in the Bronx. And they filmed it in Vancouver, B.C.
Yeah,
they filmed it in Vancouver, B.C., and you can see mountains in the background several times. And you got to wonder, what mountains are in New York, in the Bronx specifically, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I just find that funny, yeah. You know, but people are so enthralled with it that sometimes you miss it. And the same thing happens in books. I mean, if you really look and you really do, I mean, I think authors try to do as best of a chance as they possibly can to make sure they get stuff right. Times, and who was talking? With me, I think it was you, where somebody was writing about the 70s, but his partner was on a cell phone. It's like, wait a second, dude. It was you. I tell this story, and I'm like, and so I tell our authors, I'm like, you have to watch what you're doing. Because I said, there's someone I know, and now I can say it too, because I forgot who it was, who said they read a book, and somebody was in the 70s, and they're talking on a cell phone. And it's like, yeah, there's no freaking cell phones in the 70s you're walking around talking on. Okay, that happened. Even Law and Order, they still had to run to a payphone. They didn't even have a damn radio they could call back to headquarters on. So I find that funny. Yep. So I don't think he's going to make it on, because it is 8:15 our time, so I don't think he's going to make it on, but we'll get him back, and we'll still have the questions, but I do think that, you know, I think authors like to experiment. I think sometimes they get a little bored. They like to experiment. Sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't. You know, not every author's hit a home run. I don't know of one author that you can look over his entire career, even King, Koontz, Child, you know, any of them. Oh, yeah, they're all great. I don't think you can do that. I don't think you can.
Some of my favorite authors have written terrible books. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. But it's just like music. Same thing. You know, Van Halen, Aerosmith, bands like that. They didn't all have fabulous albums. They had some clunkers in there.
They had some fabulous albums? No, I'm kidding.
Okay, I'm sorry. Mr. Grunge Seattle, but still. We're not all listening to Nirvana and beating Courtney Love.
Well, let me ask you a question. Hypothetically, because I've had authors tell me this, you are writing in a series and you want to try something different, and your publisher is saying, no, you have to do another book in this series. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, as the author, does the fact you're having to stay with something you don't necessarily want to write a book about make the difference in why it doesn't work as well?
I think it does. And I will say that, you know, and I'll use music again as another thing. I think that you can tell if you really, really look at some of your favorite bands and the albums that they did at certain times, you can tell that this band was ready to break up, that this band did not want to do what they were doing, but they were forced to do it and they did it anyway, and it caused friction. But I think that sometimes some of these authors don't think. And the reason why I say they don't think is because they let the money do the talking. And let's just take, for instance, and we'll just take somebody, and I have no idea if this is true. I'm using this as a total example if I was in the shoes. So anybody who's emailed me or whatever, please, this is total fabrication. But let's just say somebody, like we mentioned John Stanford, and he's written so many Prey books for Lucas Davenport. If he was tired of writing Lucas Davenport, think it would be smart then to sign on for a 3 or 4 book deal or say, I'll tell you what, after I'm done with this book, if I want to write another one, we'll sign a 1-book deal and then another 1-book deal, or it's like, or if you don't like that, then I'll just go someplace else. What do you think? Would you do that?
No. That's interesting. Because using that example of John Sanford, he's got a science fiction book coming out now.
Right.
So,
now, he's
so,
probably an author that might be a bad example because he could probably write the phone book and his publisher will publish it because they know it'll sell. But I think that the theory still holds true, is that if you're someone like a Jane Ivanovich, you know, Lee Child, and, you know, people that have written for longer series, is that maybe they experiment within the series, and that's where they get their bread and butter. But let's face it, they have enough money that they can probably do whatever they wanted. So I would absolutely love to see, you know, some of these authors break out like Sandra Brown did and wrote that Sweetwater book, which was totally different than anything she's ever done in her entire life. But it made her feel good to finally write it. But you do hear of a lot of authors that are like, yeah, you know, I'm contractually obligated to do another this book or this book. And I sit there and I question, I'm like, if you sound so upset, why did you sign the freaking contract? Why did you do that? Why didn't you just do it as 1 book at a time instead of saying you're going to do 3? Did you let the money do the talking? Do you need all that money? I mean, are you spending more than you're bringing in? I almost question sometimes the mentality of the author to do that.
I can actually answer that. I've had several authors tell me when I approach them and say, hey, I thought this book was fantastic and it's not part of their series, they'll say to me, and you know, the sales were half. And in order for me to stay writing, I've got to write another book in that series that I didn't do because the sales were so terrible, even though it was a better book. So if they want to keep doing it, they got to sort of stick with what's got them there.
But if you're making, who was the one? Was it Patricia Cornwell who signed a $100 million deal? Contracts up. Can't you just write whatever the hell you feel like writing, or do you just want to keep writing Scarpetta because you want to sign another $100 million deal? You know what I mean?
I would say that she had another series and she did a couple books of those. And do you see her writing those anymore?
No. And maybe if she, but I think that if you're an author of that caliber that has that kind of money and you're still letting the sales do the talking, then I think that you kind of stopped being an artist at that time and you're doing is chasing the money. And I feel sorry if that's what you're doing. I feel sorry for
you. We had Tess Gerritsen on our show here, and she talked about the new novel that is a standalone. And actually, she was at BEA, and I got a copy of the book, and I'm looking forward to reading it. And it looks fascinating, and the cover's pretty and everything else. But I would guess, just based on the way things work, when people see it, they won't pick it up because it's Tess. They'll say, oh, well, it's not a Rizzoli and Isles, so I'm not interested. I hope that doesn't happen, but I have a feeling that's what will happen.
In one of my letters from the editor, I actually talked about this exact scenario. And the thing of it, and this is how I did it. And I said, if you're a fan of a Tess Gerritsen, or if you're a fan of a Lee Child, you're a fan of a John Sanford, you're a fan of a Janet Ivanovich, you like them because of the entertainment that they've given you. And they've given you 24 novels of one character. Why wouldn't you trust them to deviate from this and write something else and support the author? Because they gave you so much happiness with this. I think that you need to give them a break, because anybody who does the same thing over and over and over and over again eventually gets tired. I go, you need to trust the authors that you love and trust that they're going to give you another great book, even if you know it's Lee Child, and you pick it up, and you're like, well, this isn't Jack Reacher. I don't like it. Well, how do you know? Here's an idea. What if you just, like I said, just strip the freaking name clean, and I say, here, I want you to read this book. And then after you're done, it's like, oh, yeah, did you know that was Lee Child? And you're like, well, what? I mean, how many fans of Stephen King sat there and said, he did Stand By Me, what? He did Shawshank Redemption, huh? He did The Running Man? I just thought he was it in Pet Sematary. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
as far
right,
as I'm concerned, if it's the author, I love them.
Yeah, there's not a lot of authors that I guess that you can, you know, that can get away with that. And I think that's unfortunate. You know, I do. I think that's kind of unfortunate. But, yeah.
I think that works in your fantasy genre as well. I think
it's
the same thing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, fantasy genre is one of those things. The only good thing about fantasy, I guess the reason why I like fantasy and horror so much is because there's no rules. With thrillers and suspense and mystery, you have rules. You kind of have rules to, you know, mystery. It's like the whodunit, and then the thriller, it has to be so fast. And you know, whenever you go to these events, they say, you know, you have to pace the thriller, and, you know, the suspense, you have to kind of hang back, and you kind of got to give a little here, give a little there. You know, the mystery, it's like, you know, everybody has means and motive and opportunity and who did it and who's lying. But with horror and fantasy, all the rules are out the window. You can write whatever the hell you want about, and you don't have to sit there and say, well, it has to have this. Well, no, it doesn't. It can be whatever it wants as long as it scares the shit out of you. Well, it has to have this. It's like, well, no, it doesn't. As long as it's just like a fantasy kind of world, you can do whatever you want to. Hell, they've created new languages. I mean, I think J.R.R. Tolkien created
all
new elven language.
All fantasy is world building.
Is that? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you build the whole thing on your own. You do whatever the hell you want.
That's right.
Well, Jeff, I'll tell you what. We're going to end this. I guess we should end this now. He's not going to be on Nelson, but we're going to have to contact him. We'll get him back on. That's okay. You know, it's happened before. Like we said, we knew he had an event. It was going to be, you know, tough maybe to get him on anyway, just because of the timing. But I'm sure that, you know, we'll be back. And he even mentioned that he was excited about coming on. So,
yes.
You know,
yeah, I'll
find
out what happened, and we'll see about maybe recording some other later or something. So, yeah,
if we have to record the interview, we can always record it and then play it on the show. We can always do that, too. So nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
But we'll figure something out. All right, everybody. Well, hey, Jeff, do you have anything going on, or is everything good? You want to promote anything?
No, everything is good. And, looking forward to the next show. We got Grant Blackwood.
Grant Blackwood, who's writing a lot with Clive Cussler and a lot of other things that he's done. So that'll be good
Clancy.
To see Grant Blackwood.
Yep.
And then Patrick Lee's coming up. So we got some good guests that'll be on the show. So everybody, don't forget to check out SuspenseRadioNetwork.com, SuspenseMagazine.com. Until next time, we want to say thank you so much for joining us, and we will see you all very soon. Good night, Jeff. Have a good one, man.
Good night.
Bye-bye.